Good morning, and welcome to this Wednesday, March 16th, 2016 edition of Writers on Writing. We're on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine, streaming on the web at kuci.org and available via podcast. More about that during the second half of the show. I'm your co-host, Nicole Nelson. Each week, Barbara, Marie, or I talk to authors, poets, or literary agents to give you insight and up-to-date information on the art and business of writing and publishing. I'll be talking to two guests this hour. During the second half of the show, I'll be on with Anna Winger, author of the book This Must Be the Place and co-creator of the drama television series Deutschland 83. But first up, novelist Amy Gottlieb. Amy's fiction and poetry have been published in Other Voices, Lilith, Puerto del Sol, Zeke, Storyscape, the Bloomsbury Anthology of Contemporary Jewish Poetry, and elsewhere. She has received a literary fellowship and residency from the Bronx Council on the Arts and an arts fellowship from the Drisha Institute for Jewish Education. Her debut novel is The Beautiful Possible, published by HarperCollins, and I'm so pleased to welcome her to the show to talk about it. Hi there, Amy.
Hi, so delighted to be here. Thank you.
Well, let's jump right in and have you start by introducing your book to us. Would you tell us what it's about?
Absolutely. The Beautiful Possible tells the story of a post-war love triangle between three people caught between worlds. Walter Westhaus is a German-Jewish refugee and a spiritual nomad. Rosalie Karam is a free-spirited rabbi's wife trapped between tradition and a kind of feminist longing. And her husband, Saul Karam, is a conservative rabbi whose crisis of faith reveals and conceals the boundaries of his identity. The novel is narrated by Rosalie and Saul's daughter, Maya, and serves as a meditation on family secrets, faith, and doubt, and how storytelling interprets and shapes how we understand previous generations.
Yes, and I've heard you say about this book that in many ways it's a book of questions. Can you elaborate some more on that?
Certainly. The book has, at its core, there's a lot of, there's much in it that's enigmatic. And my characters are confused at their core in many ways. And they're filled with, first of all, they're spiritual leaders, each in different ways. Walter is a secular historian of world religions. Saul is a somewhat traditional conservative rabbi. And Rosalie is his wife, and she's also very much aligned with tradition, though she's yearning for something else, something much broader than that. And she really wants to break the boundaries of what's available to her, as certainly as a woman and also as a rabbi's wife. So as I played with these three characters, I came across the fact that their motivations were often aligned with spiritual questioning, questions about desire, about the boundaries of marriage and of faith, and about what it is to be human. So as I'm talking to readers about the book, I'm discovering that people are really enjoying engaging with my characters and questioning their motivations and their challenges. And I'm very pleased about that. It was deliberate.
In order to begin a book, it's said that you should start with a question in mind rather than an answer. And so did you have one question that started off this story for you, or what was your as the author entry point into this tale?
So I did start with a single question in mind, and that question was, how do we pass down what we know and love from one generation to another? And as I began writing the book, I was invited to explore other questions close to my heart, like, what does it mean to love Jewish texts and care about ancient words that were written a really long time ago? What are the boundaries of faith and of marriage? What does it mean to be a nomadic soul? And what does it mean to be a member of a tribe? And as a writer, I also wanted to consider, what does it mean to tell a story in the first place? So those questions were always with me as I was working.
When you were introducing the story, you characterized Rosalie's perspective as one coming from a feminist longing. And I did, relate particularly to Rosalie. Could you go into some of your inspiration for her character in particular?
Absolutely. So I grew up in a New York suburb in the 1960s and 70s. And my mother's friends would come over almost every night of my childhood in rotation, one at a time. And they would sit at the table and reveal really what was going on in their hearts. And most of these women had not gone to college. They were very aligned with passing down Jewish tradition. At the same time, they wanted so much more than what they had. And they would come to the table and they would gossip, and they were filled with wit and wisdom and humor. And every night as a child, I would just drop everything and sit and listen to them. And their voices really informed Rosalie's character in many ways. And, you know, it was a time when feminism hadn't yet come to the suburbs where I was living. And these women were not, they didn't have the opportunities that they wanted. And their longings were very, very bold and right out there. And I have to say, it was a wonderful education for a writer.
I'm talking to Amy Gottlieb. Her new novel is The Beautiful Possible. You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI in Irvine. And Amy, would you read to us from the book?
Certainly. I'll start at the beginning and I'll read the prologue, which is rather brief. When my mother and I would enter the paneled sanctuary on Shabbat mornings, my father would peer down from his rabbi's chair and bite his lip. It was a wink of recognition, barely a gesture. I would fold my hand in hers, and we would swing our arms in a proclamation of private joy. The congregants would turn toward the aisle, gaze at their Rebbetzin in her wide-brimmed hat, and behold her as if she were a queen. My mother's body was a source of pleasure to me, the strawberry scent of her face cream, the delicate veins on the backs of her hands, the satiny texture of her summer Shabbat dresses. One dress was made of crisp white cotton patterned with red bricks. The sleeves ended at her elbow. Huge flower-shaped buttons ran down the front. A thick patent leather belt cinched her waist. I would sit next to her in the front row and lay my cheek against the bricks that covered her upper arm. My father would read from the Torah and deliver his sermon, and I would twirl the buttons of my mother's dress as if they were radio dials, and I controlled the frequency. The synagogue stairwell was my first jungle gym, its parking lot my first hopscotch course. I was the congregant's flower child, their little pet. Come sit on my lap, Maya. Point out the words to me. Have a lollipop. Sing me a little song. As soon as I learned Hebrew, my father taught me how to move my fingers around a page of Talmud as if I were a blind person reading Braille. I once believed all the words of the Torah were true, just as I once assumed that my mother and father belonged to each other in the way of ordinary married people. I was Sal and Rosalie Karam's late life consolation prize. Accident, miracle, and redemption rolled into the form of a lanky girl whose bangs reached her nose. Whenever my mother invited me to make a birthday wish, I would close my eyes and imagine things already present in this world. A white flower, an arched doorway, a footpath crossing a river. I lip-synced my favorite songs in front of a mirror, and when no one was watching, I would peek into the ancient books on my father's shelves, hungry for a phrase to swirl on my tongue and taste its meaning. At night, my parents would sit on the sofa in my father's study and listen to records. Fly me to the moon, sang Frank. Dance me to the end of love, sang Leonard. I say a little prayer, sang Dion. I would spy them studying the liner notes as if the lyrics were sacred texts, yet something about their marriage always eluded me. Our house was a palace of stories, the ancient ones in the books, the love stories in the songs, the secrets my mother whispered into the phone late at night. At times, I would drift off to sleep and imagine how all the stories were part of one great book that hummed with sadness and longing. I was once content with my flower, my doorway, my footpath. What I had was more than enough. I did not know that I was also written into this great book, and that my parents were entangled in a web of desire that began long before I was born.
Thank you. That was Amy Gottlieb reading from her new novel, The Beautiful Possible. You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI in Irvine. Now, Amy, that was the prologue, and we don't see Maya again until much later in the story. I was struck by the structure of this book because I was more than halfway through when I realized that there were really no flashbacks. It was very linear. And as someone who uses backstory as a crutch, I thought it was instructive. And so did you intend to have it have so much momentum moving forward, or how can you address that issue of backstory?
Sure. It took me a long time to figure it out. And I, like you, backstory is really, really challenging, you know, because if you do too much, it threatens to compromise your narrative and the momentum. And if you do too little, the reader doesn't know where they're coming from. So it took me years, actually, to figure out how to structure the book. But once I realized that Maya was the narrator, everything fell together, because I realized I could tell it in a linear fashion, and that the way I was telling the story and what I was interspersing would reflect Maya's own sensibility. So that, for me, that was the key of unlocking how to make this novel work.
And I read that the book took around 10 years to write, or
yes. And yeah, at least 10 years. That's the cover story. It was a good 10 years, and at one point I had to start all over again, because I had been working at the beginning in fragment style. And the story started with Walter. There's a scene in the book in which Walter is standing on his head in his studio. And that was the very first image of the novel. So I kind of wrote around the story before I could really understand where these characters were going and what their relationship was about. So at one point, I guess halfway through those 10 years, I started all over, and then things began to flow. But it definitely took a long time.
Mm. And how did you sustain the emotional intensity? Because it is very intense, and how did you do that?
So I think the way that I sustained it was the book wouldn't let go of me. In fact, at one point, I thought, I want to find a way to finish this project or abandon this project. And I did think of letting it go, and I was writing poetry at the time. And I thought, you know what, I can finish and revise and send out a poem, and that could be so much more gratifying than undertaking this long project that may not succeed. But what happened is the characters in the story stayed with me no matter what else I was doing. So in many ways, over those years, I was actually meditating on the book, and it wouldn't let go of me. So I think that's how I sustained the emotional investment for all of that time.
Mm. And along the way, did you have to do research into different facets of Judaism or religious teachings, or how did that element work its way in?
Okay, so first of all, in terms of the Jewish sources, I have been a Jewish seeker for all of my adult life. So all of these texts and all of these questions were part of my life, part of the texture of my life, intellectually, personally, spiritually, in every way. I was also working for 14 years as an in-house editor for an organization of rabbis. And I was editing theology and scholarship and works of spirituality. And that gave me a great lens into the personal lives of rabbis and their families, and that definitely informed the book. There was one bit of research that was really quite wonderful. Walter's journey was inspired by the accounts I read about German Jews who fled Nazi Germany and made their way to India. And I read about one man named Alex Aronson who found his way to the ashram of the Bengali Indian poet Tagore. And once I had that story, that invited me to weave Tagore's poetry into my novel, and that opened up new possibilities and new connections. So that was really so gratifying.
And while you were holding that job as an editor, were you also writing poetry?
I was writing poetry. At a certain point, it was hard to sustain the work of this long novel, and I was waking up earlier and earlier to get some work done before my children woke up and before I had to go out to work. So there were times where I needed to really stay alive as a writer, and poetry really helped me. I realized I could, you know, try to write a sonnet or try to fool around with an image, and, you know, I could, you know, I wouldn't be bogged down with massive pages and manuscript and backstory and everything I was trying to weave into this book.
I'm talking to Amy Gottlieb. Her new novel is The Beautiful Possible. You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI in Irvine. And Amy, I'm sorry to say it, but we're drawing down on our time. Before I let you go, though, I would love it if you could share some writing advice for our listeners.
Absolutely. I would advise, I mean, first of all, it took me a really, really long time to finish and to publish my debut novel. And I would advise young writers to read widely, follow their interests and obsessions wherever they lead. There's no set path, and it may take a really long time to create something worthwhile. And be curious and bold and open and enjoy the journey.
Well, Amy, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you so much. Enjoyed it.
That was Amy Gottlieb. Her new novel is The Beautiful Possible, published by HarperCollins. And Amy is going to be at the Association of Writing Programs Conference, AWP, in Los Angeles coming up. She'll be at the Blue Lyra Review Table. We think it's Table 400, Thursday, March 31st at 3 p.m. And she also has a panel April 2nd at 9 a.m. on making connections with readers. During the second part of our show, Anna Winger, author of the book This Must Be the Place and co-creator and writer of the television series Deutschland 83, will be here. So stay tuned. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine and streaming on the web at kuci.org. This show will join the other interviews up on the web and available via podcast and also available on Stitcher. And you can always visit Barbara DeMarco Barrett's website, penonfire.com, for direct downloads as well as information on past shows and upcoming shows. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. I'm your co-host, Nicole Nelson. In the first part of the show, I spoke with debut novelist Amy Gottlieb. Next up, I'll be speaking with author and screenwriter Anna Winger. Anna is author of the novel This Must Be the Place. Her personal essays have appeared in the New York Times Magazine, Condé Nast Traveler, and the Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung. Anna's radio series for NPR Worldwide, Berlin Stories, is a literary archive about the city, and she is the writer and co-creator of the television drama Deutschland 83. I am so excited to welcome her to the show. Hi there, Anna.
Hi. Hello.
So for listeners who haven't had the chance to see Deutschland 83 yet, it premiered as a series last June, I believe, on Sundance TV in the United States. And in fact, I read it was the first German language series to air on a U.S. network. It's in German with English subtitles. And could you summarize the main plot for us?
Yeah, well, it takes place in 1983, obviously, and it's about a young spy from East Germany who's sent undercover in the Bundeswehr, which is the West German army, by his aunt, who works for the Stasi. Maybe your listeners have heard of the Stasi. It was the secret police, the East German secret police, and she's in charge of the spies who work in the West. So she needs somebody young. She takes her own nephew, and she puts him, because she can trust him, and she puts him undercover in the West German army at the time that the U.S. was installing the Pershing II nuclear missiles all over Germany. So it's set against the backdrop of real history, but all the characters are made up, and we sort of set fictional characters free in that space.
And I am not a big TV watcher, but a friend recommended this series to me, and I binged on it because it was so well done. And what I realized, well, you're welcome. And watching it, I just thought, who wrote this? This writing is so much fun, and it was really great. And I heard that the young actor who plays the spy that you mentioned, Stamm, is someone who you had in mind when you were writing the role. So what was that like, having him? Were you assured from the beginning that you would be able to secure him? And how did that play into your
imagination? I mean, you know, Germany is a little bit smaller. The business is a little bit smaller than I think, like working in Hollywood. The two characters who I really wrote the roles for were his aunt, who's played by Maria Schrader, who's a really famous movie star in Germany, and maybe American audiences know her from a movie called Ami and Jaguar, which is about lesbians during World War II. She plays a Jewish lesbian in World War II. It's a really glamorous movie, but she's been in lots of great things here. And so I wrote that role for her, and with Jonas, which is Jonas Nye is our star. I had seen him in a movie that he made as a sort of late teen, maybe 19, 20, called Home Video, in which he played this kid who'd inadvertently made a sex tape that got out. And it was a really dark movie, and he was incredible. And so I got together with him really early on. I wrote the pilot on spec. And so it very early on in the process, I showed it to him, and he was excited about the character, too. So I felt like we really connected about who this character was.
And I can't wait.
Maybe another interesting thing to mention for American audiences is that, divided Germany wasn't that long ago. So people of my generation grew up with divided Germany. You know, I'm 45, and people who really remember it. It's not like World War II or, the Middle Ages. It's something that's very present in people's minds. And so when we were casting the show, there was a lot of concern that East German actors couldn't play the West German roles and West German actors couldn't play the East German roles. And as an American, that seems so absurd to me, since American TV is populated so much by British actors who just play American, right? So the great thing about Jonas, so I started asking actors if they were from the East or the West, and Maria happens to be from the West, but she plays someone from the East, and when it came to Jonas, he said, well, I was born in 1990, so it doesn't matter. So
that's really interesting. So I had a question then. I found an old interview about your book. And someone had asked you, you wrote a book that takes place in Berlin, and there's a main character who's essentially German, although he was born in America, and a young woman who is American and displaced to Germany. And someone asked you, how did you get inside the head of a native German speaker? And you said that you don't think you could have written a character that was 100% Bavarian. And this was in 2008 or so that the interview took place. And so now, fast forward, and you've written this rich cast of characters with, East German, West German backgrounds. What changed?
Well, I mean, it's funny. I guess I think of this story, it's like a coming-of-age story dressed up as a spy story, in a sense. It's really about this character who's a little bit like Alice in Wonderland, and I think that's, he's a fish out of water, he comes from this kind of gray communist situation, but he's happy where he is. He's not political. He's not naturally political, and he's thrown into the West and with all its attendant sort of positives and negatives. And he grows up through this experience of kind of assimilating who he is. I always saw him as a kind of, you know, the future of Germany somehow, because he's becomes a little bit of both. But, you know, I think, I suppose on some level, it's a little bit about my experience of coming as an outsider into Germany at all. You know, I moved here in 2002 to be with my husband, and, you know, I knew almost nothing about the country. So for me, I guess I've always been a fish out of water here. So it wasn't so difficult to inhabit his point of view in that sense. But certainly since 2008, you know, it was another, say, 5 years that I'd been here. So to that degree, I guess I still would say I couldn't write a purely Bavarian character, but that's maybe because Bavaria is so specific and I live in Berlin. So
I see. And I understand both of your parents are archaeologists.
Another anthropologist.
Oh, excuse me.
Cultural anthropologist.
Yeah, cultural anthropologist. And that seems like a good upbringing for a writer in terms of honing observations. Did it impact the way that you function as an artist?
Yeah, I actually think it is a defining feature in a way of the way I was brought up and of how I see the world. I mean, I guess the apple doesn't fall very, very far from the tree. Also another thing is that my mother is British and my father is American. So in that sense, I mean, now that I think about it, you know, they're from two countries that speak the same language but have very different cultures. So in that sense, it's not totally different from East and West Germany. But my parents, you know, we lived all over the world as kids, and they are endlessly fascinated by other cultures, by how things work, by sort of looking at the world from the outside in, from the inside out, you know. And I think conversations around our kitchen table were very much about, you know, different kinds of stories and different kind of cultural experience. So, yeah, it had a huge, huge impact, I would say.
And how about the structure? I'm jumping back here, but one of the things that struck me about Deutschland 83 was the creation of suspense, because several times Stamm gets painted into a corner. I mean, he gets found out in the first episode by a relative of the major general he's working for as an undercover editor.
Yeah, he's a terrible spy.
Yeah, yeah. And yet he overcomes all of these, you know, situations that you think, how is he going to get out of this? And so how did you approach suspense in writing this show?
Well, you know, it's really interesting. I created the show with my husband, who's German, and he is the showrunner of a really popular crime show that's very different from this show. It's been on for, I mean, he's made more than 300 episodes. So it's really, you know, been a very long-running, really popular Friday night show. And he is really good at suspense, and he produced the show, and I would say he pushed me very hard. You know, it was the first time I had written some episodes of his show over the years, but, you know, occasionally. They make 25 episodes a year, so. But I learned a lot about dramaturgy. We never use that word in English, really, but in German they use it a lot. Sort of the narrative flow of episodic writing from him. But in this case, I think we kind of brought our ways of seeing the world, or our experience together, because the show is very visual. You know, my background is actually as a photographer. I was a photographer for more than 10 years before I started writing. And then, you know, the construction of the overarching narrative is a lot like a novel, but each episode is really sort of tensely driven in a way. And I think that he really pushed me in that way, and it was really, I learned a lot from him. I mean, it's funny, when I first started writing scripts, when I had been, you know, writing novels and essays, and then I wrote my first script for him, I presented him with what I thought was an episode, and he was like, he read it, and he's like, okay, so this is the first 10 minutes. I was like, but so much happens, and he's like, no, very little just happened, you know? It's a really different way of writing, and yeah, it's fun for that reason. You know, you can sort of push at the outer limits of credibility, I guess, but keep it exciting.
Wow. And you mentioned the background in photography, and I've heard that you said what's great about film is it combines, you know, the images, like in photography, with writing, which you also love. If that's so, if film combines these two things that you love, would you return to novel writing, or are you now a screenwriter?
Well, you know, it's funny. I mean, none of this was planned. I'm writing another TV show right now for an American network that also takes place in Berlin. So, you know, in a way, it's also sort of novel. I mean, it's also kind of novelistic. But I did write another novel that I have to edit. So in that sense, I mean, I wouldn't want to give, you know, the thing that's so great about TV writing is it's collaborative, and about film in general is it's collaborative, and there's many phases of it, which is similar to photography. You know, there's the shooting, there's the planning, there's shooting, there's post-production. And with television, it's the same. You know, you have a lot of phases of the process and conversations with other people, whereas novel writing is very solitary, and it's just this one thing that you return to every day, and this world that exists only in your mind, and it's very difficult to discuss it with people until you've written it, because it's this whole world that doesn't have, you know, don't, at least I don't write outlines or anything like that, so it's a very private process, and I think there's something really wonderful about that process. You know, I was new to that as well. And I do think that making television is more similar to making photographs in that sense. But the storytelling aspect is a lot, and sort of creating a world from scratch, that is like writing novels, and I'm sure I will go back to it. Yeah, I think it's good to, the thing about novels is they're all your own. I don't know how else to distinguish it. It's like television becomes something that's, it's truly collaborative. It becomes something that's of, it couldn't be made without the other people you're working with. It's like equally shared by everyone involved, and that's what's beautiful about it. But it's also nice to have projects that are, you know, purely your own, and the thing about novel writing is it's very private in that way, so.
And so it has the visual and the writing components, and also
yeah.
film has the audio component, because,
yeah.
You know, in your book, there's this pop soundtrack that comes up, and I still haven't gotten the Wham rap totally back out of my head, but and in Deutschland 83, it's much talked about. It has this fantastic soundtrack, and you happen to have an episode end with David Bowie, you know, right after he passed. And so how does pop music or music in general also play a role in your storytelling? How do you approach that?
You know, I guess, and this probably is because I come from a sort of art, a visual art background, it's huge. Like, I feel like I can see it, like with the thing I'm writing now, which is about, well, it's about many things, but it's about a Jewish family that has inherited, that gets back a house that had, a building that had belonged to their family before the war. So they come back from the United States to Germany, and the house is occupied, and it's kind of about what happens next. It's similar. Like in building that world, I feel like I hear it. The music is a huge part of it. The visual, you know, the world, the version of Berlin that this story takes place in is very important to me. And I feel like I could see it even before, and I could see it and I could hear it even as I started to develop it, you know. So I definitely come to, you know, to screenwriting from a visual place and from a, yeah, I mean, the music is amazing, right? It was so fun to work with if you look at the top 100 of 1983, it's like every single song is still on the radio. Like, it's an incredible, for whatever reason, it was this amazing year. And because it was right after MTV started and music videos started, it was the first time that music and the visual were so strongly linked. I was 13 then, and I happened to live in Mexico at the time, and they only got MTV from noon on Saturdays to noon on Sundays in the town where I was living in Morelos. And we used to watch like nonstop. My friends and I, we would take turns sleeping, you know, just to see things like, you know, Duran Duran or The Police. And yeah, I just think it was the first time that the way things looked and the way they sounded were so, you know, linked, and there were so many creative ways to make music videos then. You know, it was all very kind of rudimentary in retrospect, but it was a special moment, I think, in pop music history for that reason.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I totally forgot about the dawn of MTV.
Yeah. We always used to joke that Berlin, and this is, I guess I allude to this quite a bit in the novel, but Berlin has this 80s vibe. And you definitely hear 80s music a lot in Berlin, like in the fashion, sort of the way people dress on the street always has a slight 80s vibe also. And but then when we tried to shoot the 80s, it turned out that actually it's as hard as shooting the 1600s. You know, it might as well have been another planet. We had to change everything. So I had always thought it would be really easy to shoot an 80s drama in Berlin, but it turned out to be very, actually kind of difficult to find the locations. And you know, when he runs down the street, you still have to change all the cars. So it presents all the same challenges as shooting kind of any, you know, a Civil War drama or something. But we did shoot the whole show on location. There's no studio shots.
And the visuals were fantastic. And I also enjoyed how you leveraged the technology of the era. And so,
yeah, right.
Like when he finds the floppy disk.
I mean, there's a really funny book that we read that was all about Stasi technology, because the dirty secret of the wall coming down is basically that it had to come down. Like, it was totally unsustainable. Like, they couldn't feed their people in the East. And starting in 1983, and it was one of the reasons we chose that year to do the show, it was the first year that West Germany started lending huge amounts of money to East Germany, even though they had these very tense political relationships. On another level, on a sort of private level, so many West Germans had family in East Germany, they couldn't just let the people starve. Mm-hmm. So there was a very strong emotional relationship to East Germany, even as the sort of political situation really heated up over the Pershing II installation. And basically, starting in 1983, West Germany supported East Germany. And so by the time the wall came down, I mean, it kind of had to come down. The East German government needed basically their population to be supported by the West. So it's, you know, and we wanted to capture also a sense of communism, or a sense of the socialism of the East as having been a failed experiment, but an experiment that in its origin had something positive about it. You know, we only ever think of it, you know, as a total failure, but it was, there were a lot of idealists behind it and a lot of worthwhile ideals behind it, and they just didn't work, you know, it wasn't successful, but it was important that this character be kind of a believer in the system that he's coming from. And kind of our mantra always in the room was, you know, no one is evil on our show, because all of our characters work for, all of our, let's say, heroes work for the Stasi, but we felt it was really important that they all be, you know, that they're all truly believers, and that, you know, good people do bad things because they think they're doing it for the right reason, and we wanted to explore that.
Absolutely. I mean, that work showed, because that was another thing that struck me so much was the characterization was incredible, and you had like this major general for the Stasi who was so sympathetic because of his just authenticity and his sincerity. And here he has this complicated family life while this, you know, world stage is having this moment. But it was nuanced, and I'm still thinking about it as a writer.
Well, thank you. You know, one of the things that it was really interesting that it was so well received in the U.S. and in the U.K., and something that has occurred to me afterwards is that, in a funny way, it is a little bit more of a sort of American-style story than is typically written about German history, because, you know, the little guy ultimately saves the world from destruction and so on is kind of an American narrative. And But what was nice was that people from the East really liked the show, and I mean, Germans really liked the show, and it was you know, the feedback here. You know, I was quite nervous actually, as a foreigner, to take it on, and then once I was in it, I was just fully in it, and I didn't think about that anymore. But it was touching in a way that people were like really excited to see their own world portrayed as exciting. I think that people didn't, Germans would not have thought, okay, the peace movement and the Stasi and the sort of West German army, like, how is this show going to be interesting? Like, or how would, for them it's too close, you know? And then when they saw it, they were super excited that just to see it portrayed in that way. And I think that was nice, you know, it was satisfying.
Well, Anna, we're drawing down on our time, but before I let you go, I'd love to have you offer maybe a writing tip to our listeners.
Well, I suppose, you know, I'm a novice, so I think I certainly serve as an example to other writers. If you're passionate about something, you know, just pursue it, keep going back to it, because, you know, I'm coming to this, you know, relatively late in life, and I was just really determined about wanting to make this story. And gosh, writing tips for me, that's such a nice idea. I think that, I guess another important thing that maybe take away from this project is that I believe that, you know, we're writers, we're writing fiction, we're making things up, and it's possible to inhabit any character. It's possible to try and understand all kinds of people's experience, and it's not, I don't think it's necessary, I personally don't think it's necessary to always write from your only from your own experience. I think it's possible to really get to identify with all kinds of people or find the common experience with all kinds of characters. And yeah, I wouldn't be shut down by someone saying, you know, you're not qualified to write that. You know, if you're feeling the story, go with it.
Anna, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you for having me.
That was Anna Winger, author of the novel This Must Be the Place and writer and co-creator of the television series Deutschland 83. That's all the time we have for today. Stay tuned for Filling the Voids with Natalia coming up next on KUCI 88.9 in Irvine. Until next time, thanks for joining us. Have a great day.